our vulnerable patients with major health disparities. And Theo, I'm sure, will talk about that. But our hospital, 66% of all of our patients are foreign born. We have interpreters for 50 languages. We have a cross-cultural, cross-language barriers. And so that would be hard enough in any situation, but in the rapidity of the gravity of this situation has caused an enormous amount of problems. And we also know that at least here in the US, health inequalities are highlighted by the inequities of social justice. And we find a higher percentage of the people with disease from vulnerable populations, from African-American and Hispanic, Latino population, because they're sicker and they're poorer. And therefore, this is theirs have a higher degree of disease and disease. Also, they have a problem with, they're more face-to-face workers, and they also, the impoverished, and they live in often in crowded rooms. They can't have the luxury of isolation or quarantine. Many of them are homeless. And so I'll leave that to Thea to talk about. But the first critique I have is that the guidelines that they were put together need to have representation of the population that's affected and the shareholders, because trust is the key issue in this issue. Before rationing, we first have to make sure that people are practicing what I call elegant medicine, using all available resources, the best practice one can do, and also make sure that one has, that we know that there are ventilators in Boston that are at different hospitals and share those ventilators. And so you want to do whatever you can to prevent getting into triage situation. But when triage is needed, whatever it takes, I would argue, whatever the principles or rules you have, and we can argue about those, whether they be some kind of lottery or whether they be some first come, first serve, or some social worth criteria. The take home that I would like you to come away with is whatever the rules are, they need to be open, explicit, and verifiable. Open, explicit, and verifiable to maintain trust and ensure justice and fairness, because the whole system is based on trust. And also, we should remember that triage occurs not just with ventilators and ICU beds, but masks and personal protective gear. And we recently had an example of a paradigm for drug rationing, which didn't go so well. And so we can imagine translating that. So this remdesivir, which was a research trial of an antiviral drug, which seems to have some impact. And after the research was over, they decided to give it to various hospitals. Well, they delivered it to 25 hospitals, but the decision was allegedly made by the Health and Human Services, where there were no criteria presented, who, when, where. Mass General got the virus, got the antiviral, and BMC, Boston Medical Center, didn't until the General decided to share it with BMC. So we have an example where it wasn't done so well, and there wasn't open discussion, and so there's question about who gets access and how do they get access. The other issue is first, when the patient arrives, there needs to be honest discussion about scarcity of resources and the elicitation of the patient's values and wishes for aggressive treatment should the need arise, and therefore preventative ethics. So this has given us an opportunity to relook at how people deal with value-laden questions, and particularly about advanced directives, living wills, so-called living wills, and healthcare proxies, which is an old problem, but this became increasingly apparent also because people get sick fast. And so we need to have the discussions beforehand as to what their wishes are, what their goals of treatment are. This has become particularly problematic with people coming and dying in the hospital when there hasn't been people with them, people have died alone. And so this is a big, big issue. Most people, if you ask them how they want to die, most people say that, they assume they have a terminal disease, they want to die at home without pain. And yet these people are dying in pain and in the hospital. When the treatment is no longer medically beneficial to achieve the goals of the patient, the medical community is under no obligation to continue such treatment, even if there were no issues with scarcity or resources. And so this is something we could talk about, but the question is, how are we determining what constitutes benefit? And this requires a discussion with the family and the patient as to what their goals of treatment are. If the goals of treatment can't be met, then we don't have a problem. But if the goals of treatment are disparate to what is possible, then we have an issue of communication problem. There's a question about discontinuing ventilators, withholding and withdrawing. And in the secular world, we make no distinction between withholding versus withdrawing. The question is what the burden and benefit is to the patient and what their wishes are. If a patient has a better prognosis, it arrives. The question is, can you take somebody off the ventilator? And we've had discussions about that, but we've concluded that you can't, unless it's independently the decision that somebody needs to be taken off or is no longer benefiting from it, you can't take off the ventilator from one patient to give it to another patient, even if their prognosis is better. Although there have been discussions about that. The classic approaches to allocation of scarce resources have been some kind of social worth criteria, which historically is what's been done. So the past, present, or future benefit, good contribution, gender, poverty, age, this approach has been found to be biased and unjust, I would argue. So people have talked about first come, first serve. The problem with that is people with limited or different access, insurance, distance from the hospital, language barriers, also discriminate against people who are at risk. So the question has come up whether you can do a random lottery, whether that's the just and fairest way to deal with allocation. The other topic is do not attempt resuscitation, and part of the treatment goals. In New York, 80% of the people who are on ventilators ended up dying. It hasn't been that way in Massachusetts. But the question is, how do you factor that into decisions about end-of-life care? The question of whether you can write a unilateral order to say that the treatment is futile, a question or of no benefit, and we have to weigh the harms and the marginal benefits. But the difference here is that people who are doing resuscitation put themselves at risk for getting the virus because, you know, you're intubating and doing a lot of procedures that are very high risk for people who are involved in caring for the patient. So we need to do a better job about meeting with the family and explaining the hospital policy, communicating and dealing with conflict resolution and palliative care. The triage that people have talked about here in Massachusetts anyway, has been based on prognostication, giving people a scoring system of what the prognosis is of being able to survive. And the problem is that with the scoring system, whether you can have preferential points added to your score. For instance, whether healthcare providers, as an example, should be given more access to life-saving treatment, whether public safety workers, the police, should have added points added to their preferential points. Pregnant women, age is an independent factor. People have talked about the elderly versus people who are younger, and assessing mortality risk is short-term. Versus five-year survival rate, which is very hard to understand, but the need for prior clinical assessment. People have talked about no independent use of gender, race, ethnic background, ability to pay, disability, incarceration, concerns about structural racism, which has become a particular big topic here in the U.S., obviously with the issue of police brutality, economic injustice, and there's also questions of legal anti-discrimination and Office of Civil Rights. So with that, let me just give you a couple take home that I would say that made me concerned and then open up and give it back to Rafi. I think the ethics are not so new in terms of the area of COVID. The timing, rapidity, and the extent of the pandemic has caused us to deal with decisions in a very rapid time. This reminded me, Rabbi Steinberg and I remember the HIV/AIDS epidemic and how difficult that was, and we didn't even know it was a virus initially. So this is an interesting parallel. Social distancing, quarantine, isolation, and contact tracing works. The question is, how do we implement it and who do we implement it with, and what kind of obligations do people have for their fellow man versus individual? I worry about people of color, the poor, the homeless, who don't have the luxury of social distancing. I think the key is primary care, and she pointed out the deficiencies in our healthcare system and how we lack primary care. And I think that we need to be humble and share our thoughts and grapple with this very difficult issue. So of that 10, 12 minutes, I covered everything you can cover on COVID-19. So I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Gurner, for that overview. I just wanted to get that out. Wonderful job in touching on many of the topics that we would like to discuss today. And I'm unfortunate that we probably don't have the time to go into depth on everything, but there are many important points there. Before we do get into and continue, I would like to encourage anyone who has any questions, please post in the chat for everyone or to me, and I will do my best to kind of direct things. I would hope we can chat now for another, say, 40 minutes or so, a little less perhaps, and leave some time for some open questions from anybody in the audience who would care to ask anything specific. As Dr. Groden has certainly alluded to, there are many facets here to discuss. the very concept of how in a pandemic, kind of the ethics of dealing with the question shift from the individual down to more of a population level and how to deal with that. But the very question of triage comes to a specific patient and shows up in your face and is in front of you and how to deal with that. Perhaps our panelists can talk to a little bit the specifics of how that should be approached. I know Dr. Brown mentioned several different ways of thinking about it, but I'd be interested in hearing more from our panelists, please.
Who are you addressing it to?
Well, Dr. Steinberg, if you've opened up, perhaps you would like to take the first shot at it.
Okay, so thank you, Dr. Grodin, for really giving almost the whole spectrum of the issues that come up in such complicated issues. Some ethicists have called it the most tragic choices in medical ethics, because no matter what you decide, someone will die because of your decision, which is very unique to a triage situation. Maybe with questions we'll get more to specifics, but I would like to give a general approach and to say first of all that this situation is neither new nor unique. Already in the Talmud from our perspective 2000 years ago, and certainly in many other cultures, the question of priority always came up. There was not enough water, there was not enough personnel to treat. Today we are talking about respirators, but the measures are not what is important to the principle. It is if you have a life-saving measure that is scarce and you need it for more people than you can supply, the question comes up. So in the old times it was water, today, thank God, at least in our countries, in the United States and in Israel, water is not the issue, although there might be countries in the world that it's still the issue. But we're talking about respirators, about ICU beds, about personnel. These are scarce resources, and that has been since time almost immemorial. Second thing is that triaging is A, happening almost daily in ICU setups. Most hospitals don't have enough ICU beds to supply the needs of all the patients who are in need of ICU beds. And by force, they are triaging who is entitled to get into the ICU or who should be taken out of the ICU because of triage concerns. And major triage decisions occur with earthquakes, with tsunamis, with many disasters. The pandemic is only one of those types of disasters. And the same ethical, legal, religious, and certainly medical questions that come up today come up in various other scenarios. It is true that this pandemic is now occupying our mind because it's here now before us. It is really in certain countries already there was a requirement for triage in Italy, in Spain. They made all kinds of triage decisions. I don't agree with some of their decisions, but they made certain decisions which they needed to do. Fortunately, in Israel, we didn't get to that. There was never a point in time that there was a shortage of either ICU beds or respirators or personnel or whatever medication we can use. There's no shortage, but it might happen. Hopefully not, but it might happen. So I think it's the right thing to be prepared for the eventuality that there will be a second wave or another type of a pandemic. We can't really predict what will happen in the near future, and therefore we should be prepared. I think for the benefit of the discussion, I would divide from a time scale the discussion into three different periods. One period is the pre-epidemic one, or even during epidemic, but without any shortage yet. And there are ethical obligations both on individuals and of societies, of countries, what to do in order not to get to the situation that you'll have to make triage decisions. And that is an obligation that we have to take into account, and I guess we can speak about it a little later. Then there is the triage pre-treatment when there is already a shortage, meaning that if 20 patients come with severe pneumonia requiring a respirator and I have only 5 respirators, I didn't yet start treating, but I have to make a triage decision who will be the 5 that will get the respirator, knowing very well that the others most likely will not survive if they are sick enough. And then there is the post-treatment or during treatment triage. We already admitted someone to the ICU, we already put him on a ventilator, we already gave him the expensive medicine, and now he deteriorates. And now there is someone else who is coming who is in a better condition with a better survival rate, taking the new condition of the one who is already being treated versus the one who just arrived. Again, there has to be some way of triaging in this situation as well. So the questions are different, both ethically, logistically, and religiously, between the 3 stages. And I guess we can later discuss specifics on each of these stages, but I think it's important to see the picture in this wider perspective.
Thank you, Reverend Dr. Steinberg. Perhaps Dr. James, both of our panels have alluded to the idea that this particular COVID-19 has had, you've seen the disparities and how it's affected various communities. And I would love to hear your perspective on how that should affect triage and how to take that into consideration, what the ethics would be then in dealing with that amongst various communities.
Well, thank you, Ravi, and thank you, Dr. Steinberg, as well. Michael. I appreciate Dr. Steinberg's presentation in terms of the 3 stages, you know, to consider. And as you were saying that, Dr. Steinberg, I was thinking, for the first time, you know, we were so entrenched in crisis standards of care as we were the first hospital to fill up really, really quickly. And it's really, really based on this whole notion of, you know, comorbidities and the things that put you at greater risk, you know, to something like this virus. So I was thinking as you were speaking, well, perhaps, you know, this is also location dependent. You know, it depends on what country you're in, you know, and what are the very, very specific situations and cultures and things like that exist in that country. I'm thinking about the pre-stage, you know, like before something like this even happens, we would have to go back centuries to, you know, reset that. Because the way it's set up right now, you know, there are 2, although there is a socioeconomic spectrum, there are clearly 2 distinct socioeconomic populations in our country. And really depends on class and depends on race. And I was just saying to a meeting, an ethics committee meeting that Michael and I were in yesterday, and talking about the fact that I can just look back at, you know, 1 decade in our particular, in America's history, and kind of look at where a lot of this began. I mean, a lot of it began, you know, several centuries ago, but the closest to is like the, you know, like the 1930s. And I kind of look at that particular decade because there are some very tangible events that occurred at that time that set up the present, the present structures we have right now. And it was very, very similar to what we have right now from the perspective of the economy. It was the end of the Great Depression of 1929. And FDR was trying to create pathways to create a way to resuscitate the country from, you know, this devastation of the Great Depression of 29. And so one of the things he did was to create pathways to wealth building. And in America, one of the most common pathways to wealth building is home ownership, because of the benefits, familial and generational benefits of home equity. So it was a brilliant plan, except at the exact same time, he established policies that created this thing called redlining, where red lines are drawn across the country. And if you live behind those red lines, and most people who did were people of lower socioeconomic groups or people of color and immigrants, you didn't have access to that wealth building pathway, because where you lived was deemed a risk. So you couldn't get access to the financial services. And so right at that moment in time, there were two distinct socioeconomic groups established in this country, because the ones who didn't have access to the wealth building pathway, they are the same communities that have suffered like they have in COVID-19. All those redlining communities, they are the exact same ones. And so, you know, it's sort of these things that have been laid bare, you know, they have historical, you know, links to them. And so, and then to carry it out, and I'm just going through like the stages that you mentioned. If you think about like during the pandemic, for example, like once you've surged, and one of the reasons why there was this, we were compelled, you know, to establish some sort of guidelines, i.e. the crisis standards of care for this, is because there are many people, including those of us who are deemed, you know, trusted people to care for human beings, who do not understand the linkages between the comorbidities and the history. And so I say this all the time, you know, doctors are taught to focus on disease. So doctors chase disease, but patients, particularly those that I'm talking about right now, they are chasing life. They can't even prioritize health. And so they're, you know, they wind up just being, you know, victims of the system, because they cannot help themselves because they prioritize survival. So it's a really, you know, complicated and really challenging sort of an issue to face like this. And it's interesting to me that all these things are sort of happening all at the same time. You know, the pandemic and, you know, all the unrest I'm sure you guys are all seeing on the TV in America. And they're all Venn diagrams. There's nothing separate about this stuff. You can find everything we're talking about, and a piece of that in there someplace. So that's the situation here and how it relates to what you're talking about. And at every single stage, it's alive and well, you know, for us in America.
Well, I know all three of you have been intimately involved in development of recommendations on a larger scale than even your own individual facilities. I'm curious if you can give us some insight to what that was like in the preparation. I know Dr. Grota mentioned it's preferable these things should be transparent and clear for everyone to see. And I think it's a little unfortunate that isn't always the case. And I think we are in a unique position to hear from you three and what it was like on the inside and what was discussed and how it was decided in the final recommendations.
Well, it didn't work out so well when we initially met the people included in the committee. There were the people that are the end users of the system, at least here at the Boston Medical Center, were not included in the discussion. And we didn't have leadership in terms of presenting the social construction issues and the discrimination and the issues in terms of fairness. Again, the one thing we could all agree on, I would hope, is that the rules need to be open, explicit, and verifiable. But beyond that, the question is, how do you make these assessments and how do you apply them? And there was serious arguments. I mentioned some of those about whether there should be exceptions to people being in the triage, whether there are some people that are more valuable or in the pandemic, again, like health workers or public safety people. But then we can talk about the person who's at the grocery store who's at risk for being the person who's in the grocery store. So the issue is that there was a lot of concern about who should be included and whether we should just have a lottery. Again, the question is who's initially going to be the decision. Again, Dr. Rabbi Steinberg's division is helpful in terms of before one comes in, how do we decide about triage? And there's obviously issues about access to the medical emergency services, to the ambulance services. And then we have the issue in the hospital, who to treat at the moment, and then as things evolve. And so the question was, who's going to make the decision? How the decision is going to be open and explicit, but who's going to make the decision, and how are we going to be verified that the decision was open and fair, and so that people can see? And so there's still an ongoing discussion, and it still hasn't been completed direct guidelines at Boston Medical Center, nor I don't believe in the other hospitals. Although this is, people kind of put it aside, which is a big mistake. Now that things are improving some, and we have less need to talk about triage, I think it's just the time when we need to talk about triage and to have those issues at least sorted out with some semblance of organization. So let me stop there.
Well, I think one of the things we did was, and you're right, Michael, we have stopped, but we did get to some a final document. The only thing that, and we worked on this together. I mean, let me just say that what we wound up establishing was some structure to be able to complete this document. And so we had one person who was leading it, who is the vice president of quality and patient safety and is also a pediatrician. And then we established and he ran all of these committees. He oversaw all of them. We had a pandemic triage executive committee whose primary responsibility was core decision-making to develop and modify and actually operationalize the different triage algorithms. They also communicated to the incident command team and would oversee staffing of the pandemic triage teams. And those are the teams that were involved in sort of having to make decisions if the crisis standards of care was actually activated. We also had a larger, broader pandemic triage committee, and there they were providing input for key decisions and serving on time limited, also ad work groups. And they also served as ambassadors, I guess you would say, for sharing the information with staff. And then we had a pandemic triage team, and that's the team, you know, we had a pager, that was the team who would be applying the triage algorithms to make individual allocation decisions. And so we had call, we were all taking a call, we had a call schedule 24 hours a day for about 2 months. We were all available 24/7. And then they had an appeals officer, who was the person who could hear appeals from the clinical teams in real time. And so that was the sort of structure we created. And then we had another team that was made up of subspecialists who sort of helped us to get to this near-term survival and what the parameters were, you know, for that. Because we sort of moved from, saving the most people to the most life years and that type thing. And so they really helped us to get as close to remove as much ambiguity in this decision making as possible. So they were subspecialists from areas like cardiology and, you know, renal, pulmonary, neurology, and even gastroenterology for things like end-stage liver disease, you know, like cirrhosis and all these things. And it was extremely helpful because they would make it so close and so tight until, first of all, let me just say, you know, all of this is unnatural to begin with. It's just not natural. So it is impossible to have something that is perfect or even kind of like makes sense. So what I'm saying to you was, you know, how you can make something as close to right that is fundamentally kind of like wrong, you know what I mean? And nonsensical. So.
Yeah, I have one question. How is the community involved in either the discussion?
So the only thing that we had left, and that's the thing that they're working on right now, Michael, is that piece, because we did not have time to actually engage the community. We, you know, there was a document that was created in terms of how to communicate to families if this was necessary, which is like something you probably like would have put, you know, it's just horrible. And a lot of it, some of the languages is tough to read, but there is a committee right now. The only committee that was born and is working really hard right now is the Community and Patient Messaging Committee. Because we didn't have time to do a proper engagement of the community, they are doing that right now. So that community is definitely active. I mean, I'm the faculty sponsor for that, or executive sponsor for that one. So they're definitely doing that. But to answer your question, we didn't do it previously.
How have you approached triage in Israel?
So in Israel, I was approached by the Director General of the Ministry of Health with the concept or the idea, it's a small country and it should be something uniform throughout the country rather than local cities or local even individual hospitals. They tried this direction. There was a whole chaos on how to choose and who to choose and how to approach it. So the idea was that there'll be a public multidisciplinary committee that will try to analyze all the relevant aspects and also be practical. So together with two of my colleagues, we were three chairpersons on the committee. The committee was composed of 26 members, representing philosophy and ethics and religion, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, representing sociology, social workers, nursing, palliative care, really a whole host of relevant aspects, psychiatry, and I divided them into four subcommittees. One subcommittee was a philosophical social one, the other one was a legal one, the third one was a religious, a multi-religious one, and obviously the fourth one was the medical one, which also was composed of senior physicians from intensivists and palliative care and internists and geriatrics and psychiatrists, really a whole collection of different approaches. And it took us quite a while to come to a document which was divided into two major parts. One was the philosophical, religious, legal aspect of the different issues that Dr. Grodin summarized briefly in his introduction, but we really tried to cover all these fundamental issues. And then there was the practical implementation part, which was a flow sheet, an algorithm, and how do you do it when you are standing in the entrance of the ICU or the entrance of an emergency room, you get a flood of people, you need to decide, you can't read 20 pages of philosophy and law, and you have to do it in a certain way. This document was accepted by the Ministry of Health. The only, and it was very transparent, it was publicly posted and everyone could relate to it, although post factum, we didn't have them during the discussions, but it was open for comments. The only group that was and actually still is very unhappy with our conclusions are the disability groups. And the reason is that although philosophically they are happy with what we said, that there's no discrimination, you don't go by groups, you go by individuals, you don't look at a disability group, at an old age group, at a kidney disease group, you look at each individual patient who comes to you, does he have a chance to survive greater than someone else? And that is based on medical knowledge, which is lacking still in the coronavirus pandemic, but at least we can get some information from other pandemics. And we included in the medical criteria performance scores, which for disability groups, that is a no-no. You can't, to them it's a discrimination if you talk about performance, because supposedly a priori they are performing less well than someone who's not disabled, and therefore it seems like you exclude them automatically from your triage decisions if you take a performance score into account. We were very careful and we listened to them and we corrected ourselves in several aspects. We were very careful to say that the performance scale is an individual performance scale related only to the chance to survive in a short-term treatment. That was the key. So that if there is a person who lost his two legs, he's wheelchair bound, but he's a Paralympic swimmer, he has priority number one. He will survive very well the treatments if he gets sick, and there's no reason to discriminate him just because his movement is less than someone else. So that is not a criterion in our understanding. But they are still not happy with it because it's the principle that bothers them, that if you say that something is related to performance, that means that they are less, their lives are less of value than someone else. And again, it's difficult sometimes to explain the nuances between the medical aspect of the individual. If someone, again, someone without two legs and is the wheelchair bound, and he is bedridden for months, and someone who is a Paralympic swimmer with the same disability, there is obviously a difference in the chance of survival between the two, and that's based on performance. Otherwise, they are the same. So we didn't feel that we can exclude this type of performance. But other than this aspect, I think we managed to cover the three stages in a way that we did not receive any criticism on our approach, although we are a little bit dissimilar from other countries in certain aspects. I don't know if time permits to go into details, but there are aspects that we did not agree on the principal point of view, on the fundamental point of view, with other ethical approaches, not necessarily because of a Jewish approach or a halachic approach, just from an Israeli ethical viewpoint. It might be a local way of thinking, but within the country so far, except for this problem, which we realize it is a problem, so far the document has been accepted. And the idea is that it should be transparent, it should be understandable to the lay people, not only to professionals. It should be uniformly applied anywhere in the country, whether it's in Yerushalayim or whether it's in a small city somewhere out, including distribution of resources, so that if someone lives far out and there are not enough hospital beds or ventilators there, it's the obligation of the country to find him a place, and we are not so big, so it's feasible, that is more available to his needs and bring him there as part of the triage decision. So that we're really trying to be very universal in the approach of life saving. And again, when you have to triage, the triage is based only on the medical prognosis for short-term survival, not how many years are left. We don't think it's ethical from our perspective to say that if a 70-year-old man comes in and a 20-year-old man comes in and they're both in the same condition, medically speaking, and they have the same survival rate in the immediate treatment, the fact that this one has another 20 years to live and this one has another 70 years to live, we didn't think it's relevant. By the way, it's not always even true. The 20-year-old one is someone who is very active, he drives, in Israel he goes to the army, he may be killed much sooner than the 70-year-old who sits quietly and enjoys life and is not at higher risk. So even that is not always statistically proven, but principally speaking, this was not a criterion to discriminate, neither by age nor by disability, obviously nor by gender and race, and even citizens of the country who are not people who live in the country, even though they are not citizens of the country, they should get the same prioritization approach as a citizen. That again is not a triage decision. So these are some examples where we might differ from other countries.
Thank you, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. I think you touched on several very important points. I do think it's very interesting to think about perhaps different conditions and even conditions that are long-term conditions that clearly affect the medical prognosis, but are unique to specific populations and how that should play a role in dealing with triage. I think it applies more broadly than perhaps just disabilities, but to other conditions that Dr. James touched on earlier. I think perhaps it sounds as the decision to look at short-term prognosis versus long-term prognosis is mainly a concern with age in and of itself, but I think it might have implications for how to look at these questions in terms of, I think we all recognize long-term prognosis is much more difficult to predict. I'm wondering, Dr. James, could you comment on some of these things as well?
Let me just, excuse me 1 minute. Let me just say, we specifically emphasize that we are not looking ever at groups. It is not the group that has a certain disease as a group will be triaged less than someone else. It is always the individual and his particular condition, his particular medical condition. The only problem with this is if you get several patients who are identical medically speaking, both are in renal failure, both have a cardiac condition, both are old or whatever, and then how do you choose between similar or identical medical situations? In most instances, it is not always so identical, so you can find differences on prognosis. But when it comes, that is an open debate whether you treat randomly or you treat by first come, first serve, or you put a lottery in it. There are different approaches. I don't think one is better than the other from an ethical point of view. This is a very difficult decision, but that is only if they individually are identical from the short-term prognosis.
Sorry, I was muted. So I think, you know, overall, like what we were trying to do is to minimize the impact of bias, even in doing, you know, making this near-term survival thing, just minimize the impact of bias and, you know, the inequitable sort of consequences. And so, you know, one of the things we did was, you know, we didn't want to use like the, I'm trying to be a little specific. So this is kind of what we did. We did SOFA with some things around SOFA. We didn't take it out to all those high scores, but it was basically sort of like SOFA and then a list and table of underlying conditions. And
I apologize to interrupt, Dr. James, but if you just maybe perhaps give a quick brief just to what SOFA is, or just even just
SOFA. So SOFA is something that was never designed even to allocate things such as this, you know. It's sequential organ failure assessment, and basically is used to look at the predictability of survival for people as their organs sort of fail in ICU type circumstances. As the chief of our critical care department here said to me, you know, it's something that would really benefit a person or a physician who has not worked in this ICU for like a week or whatever, or is new and just taking call or something and doesn't know the patients very, very well. Is something, it could be used for something to guide this person, you know, to be able to predict what this person's outcome might be. So that's what, you know, that's what SOFA is. It's also sort of counterintuitive, because when they look at the highest priority, you know, you would normally think that highest priority would have high scores, but in fact, the highest priority people have low scores. So it's really, it's complicated. It really is complicated when you're trying to do it. And we actually did simulations. Those of us who were going to be, you know, making these allocation decisions, we were like, we did simulations for this, which also was fairly traumatizing. But at any rate, so we used SOFA, and then we looked at things like end-stage renal disease, for example, and how many points a person gets. So every time you get points, that makes your score higher. So it makes you a lower priority person, you know, which puts you at a, you know, greater chance for not getting what you need, right? And so, so for example, I'm looking at the table. I have it right here, basically. I had to refresh myself on it. But it was like for end-stage renal disease, for example, people would get just two points for end-stage renal disease and you're older than 75 years old. And for like oncology, you'd get 2 points for active cancer with expected survival for less than 5 years, and 4 with active cancer with expected survival less than 1 year. And then for heart failure, 2 points for class 4 heart failure, and 4 for class 4 heart failure without things like repeat hospitalizations, frailty, cardiac cachexia, and inability to tolerate ACE inhibitors or beta blockers. And then neurodegenerative conditions, 2+ for neurodegenerative conditions with expected survival less than 5 years, 4 points for the same with expected survival less than 1 year. And finally, chronic lung disease, 2 points for chronic lung disease with an expected survival less than 5, and 4 points for survival less than 1 year. And so again, we made these things, these conditions as tight as we could, you know, in terms of severity, where there was less ambiguity. But again, and I can tell you for sure, even these things, you know, the intensivists were saying that they are horrible at predicting these things anyway, no matter what. And so it was, I mean, again, you know, obviously we didn't have to, you know, like pull a lever to use these things, but that's how we actually sort of did it. And then we had these tie-breaking sort of things, where you look at, we had a tiebreaker number one category and not a tiebreaker number two. And so tiebreaker number one was based on age. Clearly, you know, just age. And tiebreaker number two was based on, you know, essential person, you know, to society and that type thing. It sounds crazy for me even articulating it, but we made it very inclusive. You know, there's some people, and not here, but there's some places and people who have created these crisis standards of care who, you know, some people felt it should be limited to healthcare workers, for example. And when they talk about healthcare workers who are, you know, physicians or nurses or something like that, we actually used our governor's assessment of what essential means. And that goes broad. It actually means pretty much everybody. It really does mean pretty much everybody. And, you know, we had to broaden it a bit, but there was one bias. Oh, I say it's kind of like a bias. Unfortunately, I can tell you a place we got stuck where when you're talking about who these essential people are, it broadened it all the way out to people who are driving the buses, people who are working in the cafeterias, preparing the food, the people who work in environmental services. But what if you don't have a job? What if you're homeless? You know, what if you're unemployed, particularly unemployed? You know, that right there, you know, puts a person at a disadvantage. So it was kind of, you know, impossible to, you know, make it, you know, as fair as, you know, one would hope and as perfect as one would hope. But that essentially is how we broke that down.
If I may just comment on the healthcare workers or prioritizing according to importance to society, we decided, not happily, that we are not discriminating even health, we are not prioritizing even healthcare workers, even physicians who got sick due to the fact that they took care of patients.
Yeah.
And unless it is a tie. When it is a tie, then we get them an added point and they break the tie. But other than that, no one, because of his job, because of his importance, because of his whatever he is, at least theoretically, doesn't get any priority. Because otherwise, as you said, there's no end to it.
Right. And
yeah. Where do you set the line? There are issues of relatives of the physician. We don't think it's ethical that a physician should prioritize someone who is close to him, even though, medically speaking, he doesn't get it. Although we realize very well that human beings are human beings, and it's very hard to tell a physician when your mother comes in and she is on a lesser priority, don't treat her, treat someone else instead. We think ethically that is the right thing to do, but I'm not sure if it can be implemented. But as far as priority people, because they are healthcare workers, when there is a tie, we give them the added point, but otherwise not. And by the way, we felt that there's no difference between a technician who has to go in and get sick because he has to treat a patient and a physician. All those people who are directly involved with taking care of such patients and are directly at risk at the same level get the same no priority or priority depending where they are standing. So that was another issue that we felt is the right way to do.
I do want to interrupt, and sorry, just being cognizant of the time, we are already past the hour. There are one or two questions I see in the chat. There was a general question I think put to the panel, and someone had mentioned a specific question for Dr. James. I don't know if they would like to speak up before we start wrapping things up.
We lost you.
I'm sorry, can you see me now? Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you.
We didn't hear you.
Sorry, I was just saying there was someone had mentioned a specific question in the chat for Dr. James. I don't know if they'd like to speak up to pose the question as we wrap things up.
I'm trying to read it now.
I would like to ask a question of Rabbi Steinberg, which is what is the Jewish aspect in all this?
Well, it will take us another hour now.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of, you know, what you said so far, it's not any different from what the secular...
Right. So I think, bottom line, after this, let's say we discussed the whole hour now, all the sources, yeah. Bottom line, there are not major differences between what we discuss now as secular approach or legal approach or ethical approach and the halachic approach, because most of the greatest poskim of the greatest rabbis who dealt with the issue came to the conclusion that priority should be given according to the medical situation. So that is not far from the details in the differences, especially after the treatment was started. There are some differences between secular ethics and Jewish law, but before the treatment starts, when we triage, most of the rabbis agreed that you go by the medical prognosis.
Thank you. Thank you.
I actually found something that I would really like to cut and paste into the chat box. It is probably, and I would clearly say, the most profound thing I have seen or read on this question this person just asked me. And I am actually posting it right now. I'm going to copy it and paste it. I'm copying it and pasting it right now. See if that works. Ah, it's interesting. When I try to copy and paste it, let's see if it works. Yeah, it didn't work.
Maybe you have to be a co-host to do it.
Oh.
Can you get some other questions?
Robbie, how about if I send it to you? I mean,
certainly, yes. Yeah. Okay. If there are any other questions in the group as we finish up, I know we're already past the hour, but some have stayed on. Does anybody else have anything else they'd like to ask the panelists?
You have to unmute them, no?
Well, anybody's welcome to raise their hand. I can certainly unmute everyone.
Unmute everybody.
I think we're all kind of.
Oh my goodness. So Robbie, I'm looking for the email with your email address in it from yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see that Michael sent out. I'm really sorry, but I'll tell you, this is really, really, really worth reading. It absolutely is.
You can send it to Rafi. Rafi can distribute it to whoever
needs it. Yeah. I'm looking for his email right now.
Okay, Rafi,
I think I found it.
Questions?
Oh yeah, I have it. I got it.
Well, if everyone has a few moments and whoever is able to leave, we understand. We thank everyone for joining. But if Rabbi Dr. Steinberg has in a few minutes, I did find it very interesting, and you had shared the proposal that was that came out of the commission, the Israeli Health Commission. And one of the things I noticed is that in discussing whether or not, you know, removing somebody from a ventilator in order to give that ventilator to someone else was very contentious amongst the commission, and there was no decision reached about it, and it was pushed off in case of that would ever come to that. And I'm wondering what are the two sides to that, if you can talk more to it, and what is the question?
Again, it's a major issue whether you allow both ethically and certainly from a religious point of view to take one life actively in order to save another life. In other words, if someone is already on a respirator and the respirator is needed for his existence, even though it will not last long, and you disconnect the respirator, from our point of view, from the Jewish point of view, that is an act of hastening death or even of killing, as opposed to many ethical and legal systems in the world, in the Western societies, which look at withdrawing a respirator the same way as withholding a respirator. And that is not the Jewish approach. And therefore, even in such times where the chances became low for this patient on the respirator, and there's someone else whose chances might be greater, and if we'll and we don't have another respirator, to take away the respirator from the one and killing him is not something that the Jewish law would sanction. And therefore, although not all the members, actually most of the members were not religious, they were not observant Jews, many of them had the same feeling for the value of life and for act of hastening death, and they were opposed to it. And it was actually almost a tie between the 26 members. So our approach was that we put in enough of triage options, even after the treatment started, that hopefully we will not get to the situation where we exhausted all the other options which are acceptable and go to this which is so debatable. And therefore we left it out. Incidentally, legally in Israel at the moment, it is forbidden to disconnect a patient from a respirator. So it will, even if we would recommend it, it would require a change in the law. So it is much more complicated than in other countries, and therefore we decided hopefully we'll never get to it, and why bother with it now when we are so divided on this issue.
That's very interesting, Dan. I just want to take the moment, and I apologize, we've gone over time, and I understand many people had to hop off, but I did want to thank everyone for coming, and in particular our panelists for taking the time for this. I do think it's an important conversation, and it's a lot for students to learn from, and in particular having such world experts being able to join us. And it was noted before we started that in a certain sense, we're more separated than ever right now, where we're trying to keep apart, but social distancing doesn't necessarily have to be called social distancing, but physical distancing is what's key. And if we can keep connected and have the opportunity to connect to people who are physically far away, we're using that opportunity is a great importance now.
Thank you, Rafi, for putting it up together. And it was very inspiring, the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Rafi, will you be able to share that with folks or no?
Yes, I will. That will be. I will intend to post that email as a PDF to our Facebook page for the BUSM's Maimonides Facebook page. I also actually was just as we speak, seeing if it's possible to share the file in the chat box for anyone holding on who would like to try to download it. Okay. So I have it saved as a separate PDF. I'm not sure if that's simple to do. But, I definitely will post it to our Facebook page for everyone to see as a message from.
I must apologize, but I have another meeting now, so I'll get off.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, everyone. And thank you for staying after.
Thank you. Take care.
Be well, everyone. Take care. Be safe and be well.
Thank you.